Support for this broadcast of Two Rivers 30 Minutes comes in part from a grant from Striffler's Family Funeral Homes.
From TubeCityOnline.com, this is Two Rivers 30 Minutes, a weekly series of interviews with people making news around the McKeesport area. Produced by Tube City Community Media Incorporated, a nonprofit corporation. I'm Jason Toger, the executive director. On this show, we talk one-on-one with elected officials, community leaders, and others who are trying to make a difference in the Monongahela area. And we also take your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter at Tube City Online.
He has been called many things. He's been called the conscience of a community, the bard of Braddock. He has made countless films now and mentored scores of other filmmakers. He is probably the person most responsible for putting Braddock on the map since Andrew Carnegie. He is Tony Buba. You can find his website at braddockfilms.org or braddockfilms.com, excuse me. And he recently celebrated an 80th birthday. Happy birthday, Tony.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was in October. I did it as a fundraiser for the Braddock Carnegie Library because they're going through all the building. We raised $25,000.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a great night. Yeah.
You also have been posting recently that one of your claims to fame is one of the zombies in Dawn of the Dead, was it?
In Dawn of the Dead. I didn't even turn into a zombie. I was a motorcycle raider.
Okay.
I was actually the audio person on the film. I worked with George on a couple other projects before that, a sports series called The Winners. I also worked on Martin, which was a low-budget vampire film that was shot mostly in my mother's house in Braddock. And I did the sound on that. I have a bit part in there too. I play a drug dealer and I get killed in that one. And so also, and then on Dawn of the Dead, I was the audio person, but George came up with these bits for crew members and stuff, and I was the motorcycle raider. And I remember thinking, okay, I'll be running around here. How am I going to see myself on a screen? So I went out and found this enormous sombrero in a store somewhere in Pittsburgh. And I put that on, and I put on my old Air Force uniform and became a motorcycle raider.
You mentioned that film Martin, which you or someone hipped me to, has recently been posted online. I think it was kind of one of George Romero's lost films, but has been rediscovered. And I'm not a judge of horror movies very well, but what I love about that is seeing so many sights that were captured inadvertently from the train station in downtown Pittsburgh, the train station in Braddock, some of the neighborhoods, some of Braddock Avenue. It just really took me back to sit there and watch. Just I was watching the scenery, not watching the plot.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost fiction becomes documentary when you walk by there. With the Sacred Heart Church had just burned down a few months before that film, and so the ashes were there. So then George, being a quick thinker, then ended up coming up with the scene of the priest being in a temporary facility for a church, and then using. And at that time, I had this thing in my head where I still do, what is reality, what isn't, what is documentary, what is not documentary. And what I wanted to do was get almost everybody I ever made a documentary about at that time into one of George's films. So to do this crossover with these characters. So you see J. Roy, who I made the film, J. Roy, New Furniture, and you'll see him play a deacon. And then if you look in Dawn of the Dead, there's a Gary Peabody, he plays a zombie. I made a short doc about him. And even the Knight Riders, you'll see Sal running around there. Yeah, so I was doing this thing of playing around, trying to get everybody I made docs about into George's films for this crossover.
When did filmmaking, when did movies first come into your life? What's your earliest memory of the movies?
Yeah, actually, the earliest memory of the movies is my grandfather taking me and my brother up to the old Paramount Theater on a Sunday afternoon to watch a matinee, and my brother and I watching the films, my grandfather falling asleep. I mean, that's my earliest memory. Then outside of that, my dad, when he came back from World War II, one of the first things he bought was an 8mm movie camera.
So like a wind-up one or a battery?
A wind-up one. He shot a lot of movies. And it was interesting because back then, you had an 8mm camera, and on that, it had a 3-minute roll spool of film. But stuff was so expensive. I mean, that 3 minutes almost lasted you a year. You'd have, say, shots at someone's birthday, a brief couple shots of a vacation, and maybe end up at the end of the year with Christmas all in one roll of film, where today with digital, people just record everything second by second.
I think it's almost impossible to explain to people that you have this thing in your hand that will take video constantly of everything if you want. I can remember, splicing together 8mm film and, it becoming a real 50 feet of film does not go very far.
It doesn't go for, and I
And
think
it
you're
was, like you
probably in
said, it
this
was
one.
very expensive.
It was probably Super 8 when you're doing it. This was back the old 8 millimeter, which is actually 16 millimeter, but it would go through one side, then you once it went through, then you'd flip it over and shoot the other half. Then what happened when I was in a graduate school, I was taking a film history class, which was ended up being fascinating because this person really wasn't that interested in film history. So he taught the history of home movies. And people brought in their home movies. We talked about it as a genre. And I think that really helped me formulate all my ideas and working on the series of Braddock. I mean, just as of doing it as, this extended home movie.
Tony Buba is our guest this morning. BraddockFilms.com is his website. You can get DVDs of many of his films. I want to ask you about one in particular that out of all of your work is the one that really hit me, and that's Struggles in Steel, which is the one I think you did with Ray Henderson back in 96. That one just really hit home for me. But you can find out more about Tony's work, and you can buy his work on DVD at his website. How important was storytelling for your family growing up? Because I mean, it more than just the craft of filmmaking and the art of filmmaking, you are a storyteller.
The storytellers were, I mean, I guess. I'm trying to think. My dad, he didn't really have that many time much. He was a funny person thing, but he worked in the mill. I mean, he was exhausted at night, and most thing I remember my father was as a kid. He was in World War II, he was in the Battle of the Bulges. We went through the whole thing, and in the evening we'd have dinner, and he'd fall asleep on the couch, and he'd just wake up in cold sweats and be screaming and crying, and this went on for years. We'd ask, what's going on? He never talked about it, of course. But going back for storytelling, I remember my grandmother having me and my brother sitting on her lap, and she'd be reading us comic books. But I had no idea she really couldn't read English, and she was just making up the stories according to the pictures. I mean, so my brother and I mean, we were these little nerds. I mean, we just so we ended up memorizing all these comic books. We played different roles, walking to school, being the different characters in the comic books when we were kids. But that was a thing. And yeah, so it's just and I think a lot of the storytelling also, I was fortunate enough that my parents stayed in Braddock. So I was able to hang out on the street corners and listen to storytellers, listen to these older people tell these stories and do them, and especially the pacing and how they told a story. And that's really where I mean, that really influenced me in story and what it was and how to bring out these little details, these little moments. Yeah, just by listening to these old timers talk.
You went to Edinburgh and then you went to Ohio U. Was your goal always to get into filmmaking?
No. That was just serendipitous. It was an accident. I didn't start Edinburgh. I was like close to 25. I was working in different. I'd gone to the service right after high school. Joined the Pennsylvania Air National Guard. And I was 17, but I couldn't even go till I was 18. I was there for 6 months, and they said, if you like it, you can switch to 4 years. Of course, I didn't like it, so it was 6 months of active duty or 7 months active duty, then 6 years of going to meetings and to summer camps. So in the meantime, I was working at Bell Supply, which was in Braddock, and then also at the E.L. Wiggin Company over in Homewood. And after a while, I just got, I mean, I was starting to get high a little too much, because of the boredom, the job and stuff. And my brother, he even though being 2.5 years younger, he was already in college. He was going to Carnegie Mellon on a music scholarship. And so after a while, I started taking some night classes at Pitt, and that was dragging along. So, well, let me just try college full time. And then I went up to Edinburgh, and I got fortunate enough, I just got there at the right time. It was in January of 68. And I got a work study job working at the campus TV station. And also that year or the year before, they had hired this person to run the film department. His name was Dave Wyckoff. And Dave was only about 29 years old, 28 or 29, just a few years older than me, but he's already like a professor. And so he took me under his wing and taught me how to run an Agra recorder, and I worked in a film unit with him. And that's when, for me, it was doing filmmaking was really great because it was when it was a cross between being creative and also academic. I wasn't really a total academic. I just was working class. I just hadn't gotten into that, but the film may help me doing. So it also forced me to research when I was working on projects like working with Ray on Struggles in Steel. I mean, that type of thing. So I was able to combine the two. But it was really, really fortunate. Then I tell the story all the time. I could have stayed in Denver. They offered me an assistantship up there to get a. I was, had a degree in psychology to get a degree in counseling. But I also got an offer to go to Ohio University for film production. And I took off a year and ended up going to OU. And at that time, it was, things were quirky back in the early 70s. And, my undergraduate, I mean, I had probably like 2.6 or something. Of course, 2.6 today with great inflation probably be like a 3.8,
Probably a 3A, yeah.
But anyway, so I had like a two. So it wasn't the greatest of grades, but the, and I had really not that much experience, but the chair of the department, he decided that year to take anybody with a funny sounding last name. He accepted a Kathy Kodak, a Tommy Tucker, a Tommy Tuttle, and a Tony
And a Tony
Buba.
Booba.
Exactly. He says, "You didn't have to say, I just want to see what a booba looked like." He was, and of course, and he accepted other people, but he also took a group of people that were, came from different backgrounds, both economically, socially, and different type of majors, from sculptors to painters to people in psychology to English, because he wanted, and he wanted an older group and put them together and see how the dynamics would play out, what we could actually learn from each other. And so that was, it's something you can't do today. I mean, it just, the way academics are going. But back then you could, and I was just, like I said, a lot of it was just a matter of timing. So what happened is I started, came back home one weekend and they were selling off my grandfather's shoemaker shop. We'd been renting it out till that time to another person. And so I made a short film about that. And then I just started going back and forth because I had been gone for a period of time. And I returned and I just saw the change that was coming. You sort of felt it that this type of community is not going to be like this in 20 or 30 years, and these characters won't exist.
That's a good place for us to take a pause. We have to take two quick 30-second pauses. When we come back, let's pick it up there because your independent filmmaking career, when you started to go out on your own, really did mark kind of as the downturn began for the Mon Valley. Tony Buba is our guest this morning, BraddockFilms.com. We'll tell you all about him and all about some of his work. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Support for this broadcast comes from Striflers Family Funeral Homes. Since 1866, Striflers has provided compassionate, professional memorial services for families in White Oak, McKeesport, Dravosburg, Portview, and the surrounding areas. Striflers offers comprehensive pre-planning services and aftercare. And through its affiliated company, Design Monuments, Striflers also provides permanent markers and memorials crafted in stone, bronze, and other high-quality materials. Learn more at Striflers.com or call 412-678-6191.
When we took the break, you mentioned that you returned from Ohio University, you got your Master's of Fine Arts, returned to Braddock, and as you put it, you could tell that towns like this weren't going to exist much longer.
Yeah, if you go away for a while, maybe 5, 6 years, and you come back, you can see how much like your grandparents have aged or slowed down. And that's sort of what happened, what I did. I came back and just sort of saw that the change that was coming, even though for a lot of, I mean, for Braddock, actually, the decline started in the 50s. Yeah, I mean, that was really, I mean, the heyday for Braddock was like 45 to 55. And when I was growing up, it was in decline. But I don't think anybody thought it was going to, even I didn't ever thought it was going to, drop that much.
I think
But
the same
yeah,
thing was
so
happening in Duquesne. The same thing was
it
happening
was
in
exactly.
Clairton, McKeesport, Manesson, Donora, right up and down
Yeah,
the
the
river.
thing. Yeah, and when I was in grad school, I ran across a group of people from Apple Shop, Whitesburg, Kentucky. And they were a group of, people my age, a little younger. They were so tired of groups coming in from New York or from Los Angeles making films about Appalachia. And there was one time, I think, when it might one of the CBS people, they were like telling people to send shoes at Christmas time to the poor people of Appalachia. So they ended up starting their own media center called Apple Shop. And that was in the 70s, they started making films of what they thought better represented their culture, in the culture of Appalachia. And that was really inspiring to me. And then coming back to Braddock, and then I really hit the jackpot. I mean, Ray Henderson and I were friends in high school, sort of separated, lost contact a little bit, came back together through the Braddock Carnegie Library, and renewed our friendship. And then when Ray lost his job at Duquesne, and they ended up airing a documentary on Channel 4 about steel workers losing their jobs and didn't have one black person in it. And Ray was outraged. So we ended up, he says, can we do anything? And really, what we wanted to do was just like a 15-minute rebuttal to that film and show some workers. We went out during the summer and we had high eight. We didn't have any money. It was just like almost a consumer type camera and shot a lot of interviews. And I said, man, this story is much bigger than me, because almost everybody we interviewed went and back and referenced A. Philip Randolph. I mean, the March on Washington. It was real. So out of that, we cut together a 10-minute sample and then started applying for grants. And we raised about $250,000 for the film, which took about a 4 or 5 year period to do. And then we had this really extended rough cut. It was like about 2 or 2.5 hours. And then let's send it off to Sundance. Just to know that I'm still around, because I was there with the film earlier with Lightning Over Braddock. We sent it off to Sundance, and we got accepted on this rough cut. So of course, then we had to really work hard to get it down to a 90-minute version for the festival. This was like at Thanksgiving time, and the festival was in January. So we did, and we went there. And so Ray and I were at the Sundance Film Festival together, actually with my brother too. He was there with the film. He edited it with for Al Pacino, called Looking for Richard. So you had Sundance, you had three people from Braddock, which I tell everybody was probably the largest
Per capita.
per capita population ever from one community at Sundance. And then at the Sundance Festival, Ray and I, two middle-aged men, with this festival, and there's young people there hustling, trying to get their careers together. And you had the people like introduced the thing where you got in, all the directors got introduced, so we're going through, and everyone going down the line, we really want to thank Robert Redford and the Sundance Film Festival. It's such an honor to be here for them to think our film is great enough to be in this festival. So they're doing this down, going down, going down. So it gets to Ray. Ray says, he looks out the group, says, I ain't never been around so many white people in my entire life. He said, you all got an outreach problem here. And I was just like, that was Ray. I mean, he just like spoke his mind. He was just an amazing individual.
We're talking with Tony Bova this morning. Ray passed away, I think, in 2017. Does that sound
Right,
about right? Yeah.
I really miss him.
When you were before Lightning Over Braddock, because that was really where you went national. You became a
Right.
big national figure in especially in documentary making. But before that, when you were walking around Braddock and North Braddock with, I'm assuming, a Bolex 16-millimeter camera.
Yeah, either Bolex or the if I was when I was still in school, I had access to it, like an Eclair, an Aeroflex, or some of the Pittsburgh filmmakers were still in existence there, and you can get like a sync sound camera.
Did people kind of look at you funny? Did they kind of look at you?
Oh,
Well, who is this guy that wants to come down and make a movie at my furniture store?
it was. I remember I just gotten a Guggenheim Fellowship, right? Which is like it's like an Academy Award for someone like myself. I got this. And so I went down to the post office and mailed something. And the person working at the post office, I just got this gun flying high. I just got this Guggenheim. Hey, Tony, do you think you're ever going to make it? It was like, up and down. So everybody just sort of brought me back down no matter what. At first it was sort of interesting. People were wondering what you're doing. Then after a while, people wanted to make need to make documentaries about them. I mean, that type of the input, like Sal, that's how that came about. But so it was even when I was defending my thesis for my MFA, they asked me if I think I could make a film if I ever left Braddock. And I said, I don't think I ever have to leave Braddock, to make a film. But and which for most of the part is true. I mean, I've done other work, but Yeah, but I've been concentrating all 50 years on the community.
You're a little bit modest because, I mean, it's not just a Guggenheim. You've gotten fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts on multiple occasions,
This is
American
right.
Film Institute, Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, Pennsylvania Humanities Council.
Yeah, Rockefeller Foundation,
Yeah,
nothing to
people have recognized the value of what you do. Did that surprise you at all?
But to me, what's interesting about getting those grants, I mean, is that I'm able to get those grants because that money's actually, for me, is like blood money. I mean, you get money from the Guggenheim or the Rockefeller Foundation, you really have that money because someone else got exploited
Right.
and someone made a big profit. And now with that profit, they give it to a foundation and I'm benefiting from it. But there's some poor kid in Africa, like mining lithium or something, or somebody somewhere else, from West Virginia with the coal industry. I mean, it's really the exploitation from slavery. I mean, I really have to look at that, those grants, not through the vision that this is great, I got it, and it's celebratory, but also through I got those through the pain of other people. I mean, it's really a yin yang with when I think about the whole granting process. And
We can go even closer than that because I'm old enough to remember when my grandfather and some of his friends would not walk into a Carnegie Museum or a Carnegie Library because they still knew the stories about Carnegie.
exactly. I mean, the book that just came out about the Hillmans and the family owning slaves. I mean, it's just, yeah. So you take this. I mean, you accept it there, but it's celebratory. But it's, you can't get too fool yourself because you have to realize where this money's coming from. I mean, it's.
BraddockFilms.com is Tony Bubba's website. You can follow him there. Probably, again, needs no introduction to a lot of people from the Mon Valley, but I would encourage you to check out some of the clips that are online, not just of Dawn of the Dead, not just of the Sombrero motorcycle gang or rider, but some of the great work that he has done telling stories from Braddock and the surrounding area. From the Tube City Center for Business and Innovation in downtown McKeesport, this is Two Rivers 30 Minutes. We'll be back in 30 seconds to wrap things up.
Support for this broadcast comes from the City of McKeesport Fair Housing Office. Fair housing is your right, and the Fair Housing Act prohibits discrimination in housing because of race, color, national origin, religion, sex, gender identity, sexual orientation, family status, or disability. That includes renting or buying a home, getting a mortgage, seeking housing assistance, or engaging in other housing-related activities. For more information about Fair Housing Act protections in the City of McKeesport, call 412-675-5020.
He's been called the Bard of Braddock. He's been called the conscience of the community. Does that embarrass you at all, Tony Buba, when people say things like that?
I think the Bard of Braddock, I think that came from Lynn Collin. I think
Okay.
she's the one that
She
coined
started that.
that. She was always she loved her alliterations.
Yeah, sure.
That was that. Especially since my knowledge of Shakespeare is not great.
Better than mine, probably. You mentioned that, when you started out, I mean, we started out as a little kid with a wind-up 8mm camera, graduated to an Aeroflex or a Bolex 16mm camera, Nagra tape recorder, which, if I remember correctly, was a reel-to-reel recorder. So,
Real.
when you used to go out even a few years ago to do a film, you had all this equipment. You had a battery pack on you. You had lights on you. You had a microphone on you. You had a camera on your
Yeah,
shoulder.
at
And
least
usually you had
three
another
person
person helping
crew.
you. Yeah, two other people probably walking behind you, helping you. Now you can get a digital camera for under $1,000 that'll do a, 4K HD video.
Yeah, I went to I myself and John Rice and my wife and we went and with Marcus Rediker from the University of Pittsburgh. We went to Africa in 2014 and made a documentary, which is online. You can go to Pitt's website and it's on. It's called The Ghost of Amistad, and we had these little Panasonic digital cameras, and and made a feature film. It ended up being playing festivals and being on PBS, and it was just something it was been unthinkable like 10 years earlier. I mean, there is a sort of this nostalgia for 16 millimeter by some people, but for me, as I'm at this age, man, I'm just so grateful that this equipment's come down to this small size that I could still work.
And the cost has come down too. You're not
The cost
paying
has come down,
for
and
soup and
yeah, that
film.
would be that's the tricky thing, because and that's sort of for young filmmakers. I mean, the cost has come down, but so that the but so used to be the gatekeepers were on the front end, where you had to apply, you had to have a well-written proposal, a grant to get the money to get going on a film. Today, you don't need that. But the gatekeepers are on the back end. How do you, once you got that film made, and it was halfway decent, you were guaranteed some exposure because of all the gatekeeping that was done in front. But with no keeping, how do you get, when you get this film done, how do you get it out there? How do
Well,
you
there
have
are
people
very
see
few.
it?
Pittsburgh Filmmakers is not with us anymore. There are very few what we would call art houses or
Right. Yeah. So
those kinds of
that's
movie
it. So
houses.
we've seen the shift, like in Pittsburgh with independent filmmaking. Most people are going to like short narratives in hopes that would lead to a career in making a longer fiction film, which, I mean, that you might as well play the lottery with some of that. I mean, it's like, because there's, I mean, also the big difference now, and I'll be honest, is that, I'm at the age where my competition, you figure, I had no comp, it was like there are very few women in the industry at that time. If you wanted, if you from Europe or from another country to get your film into the United States, all these customs you had to go through. So my competition was much less than people were going to go today because there's so many talented people out there. I go to a festival, you have a little health problems, and I get down to Athens this year. As you go to the Athens Film Festival, there's just so many amazing work. And one of the things I think is problems around here now, a lot of the work I see is just really sort of derivative narrative work. I mean, do we need another coming of age that sort of doesn't bring anything new to the table? Is that kind of, or another, horror film that really is not dealing with any type of social issue, but just doing being splatter? I mean, it's that kind of thing. So, for a young film, I really find figure what is, why am I making this? Why am I doing this? What am I thinking? This is like 30 years from now. Am I doing it just to try to make a quick buck now and have this make this? I mean, that's fine if you want a commercial. If you want more of the artistic end, you really got to think of what is the long term.
We had a gentleman, and we're just about out of time here, but we had a gentleman on this show several years ago by the name of Sam Zoltan, who did a film about the Jews of McKeesport and then the diaspora, not just the Jewish diaspora, but the McKeesport diaspora
Yes.
that after McKeesport went through its troubles, as Braddock did, and people scattered. Let's say somebody wants to be the next Tony Bubba or Sam Zoltan, and they don't care if they make $1 million or even $100. They want to make this film for their family, for their church, for their temple, their social group. How do they start? Where do they start finding the story and telling the story?
Yeah, I think one is, I mean, for me, this is just like for my own personal end, is that you start with your family, and build up with short films, and how do you keep the pacing, and how do you do that and start out with short work, but really, what is the closest to you and your family? How do you present your family in a different light? I mean, working on this film now, which I'm having a difficult time with, it by my mother, because she was such a nice person. I mean, there's no conflict. She didn't drink. She didn't have affairs. She wasn't bipolar. I mean, so how do you make a film like that interesting? So you look for those challenges that bring it out. But that is really you're doing. Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, there was one person who was working on Julie Sokolow, who's done some amazing work on films. I think she's gone into counseling now. I don't know if she's still making films, but she was an amazing young filmmaker.
We've been talking this morning with Tony Bubba. You can check out his website at braddockfilms.com. We haven't even talked about what some of the things that have been happening in Braddock over the last 8 to 10 years that I know you were part of the fight to save Braddock Hospital.
Right.
We're also seeing people walking around on Braddock Avenue again and hanging out on Braddock Avenue again, which to me does my heart good. Tony Bubba, don't be a stranger to us. When your next film is ready, please shoot me a message and let's have you on again, okay?
Okay, good. Thank you so much. This has been fun.
Thank you so much for talking with us, Tony Bubba, and thank you all for listening this week to Two Rivers 30 Minutes, broadcasting from the Tube City Center for Business and Innovation in downtown McKeesport. So long for now.
You've been listening to Two Rivers 30 Minutes, copyright Tube City Community Media Incorporated. Opinions expressed on this program are not those of Tube City Community Media Incorporated. Listener support makes this program possible. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible contribution, please visit our website at tubecityonline.com and click on the donate link. You can also get a free subscription to this program and other podcasts at our website using Apple's iTunes or Stitcher.com. If you've got a question or comment, we hope you'll write to us. Our address is Tube City Community Media Incorporated, P.O. Box 94, McKeesport, PA, 15134. You can email us at tubecitytiger@gmail.com or call us at area code 412-614-9659. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Tube City Online.